Thank you all for being here. To be honest, this is my first CCC. Is it the case for somebody in the audience? Great. I usually cannot be here because of family reasons, and the only way I could find to get here is to get accepted as a speaker. So here I am. So, as the angel says, I'm a security researcher. I live in the French-speaking part of Switzerland. I do a lot of embedded devices. I'm also part of organizing a way smaller conference called Black Alps in Switzerland, and also I'm responsible of the main, I'm the main core developer of the Hydrobus. It's basically it's a hardware Swiss Army knife. So the target that we will see today is the Cipolo 1. It has been released in 2019, so 3 years before the AirTag went. So that means that there's no specific protocol for the Bluetooth tracker. It's a plain Bluetooth device. So it has the exact same functionalities. Basically, it's a Bluetooth tracker. It has an application that you can use to make it ring, like that. And it helps you recover your keys, your cat. It's really in the on the website. It helps you recover your cat. Never tested, but I will first start by the end. You will see why later. So, at the end of this research on September 15, we sent an email to Cipolo, and on September 20, we got an acknowledge from them. They asked for more details, and we set up an online meeting with the Cipolo team. So there was 8 different people from the engineering, from the management, various people from Cipolo. They were really interested. We did a presentation kind of this one with a bit more context and several questions. The good thing was that they were really open for discussion, so we had some weird things that we found in the firmware, so we asked questions, and they were really kind and willing to explain the issues. Some of them were, let's say, by design, some others were plain mistake by them. By the end of this meeting, what really stand out was that the device they used had a really small memory for storing the firmware. That means that they had to make some choices and remove some features and some security checks in order to make the firmware fit within the microcontroller. So this is why you will see some of the issues, but they also acknowledge that they did some mistakes and overlooked several security features. They were also kind enough to let me present here. The only thing is that they asked me to not publish the encryption keys, so they will be redacted in those slides. Okay, back then. So, we got the device, we crack, this is just a simple plastic case, so we can just crack it open, and this will give us this small white PCB here. And there are 3 components that are really interesting. The first one being the microcontroller itself. The second one is the sound driver. It's mostly used for the beeping and stuff. And as you can see, there are a lot of various test points. So this chip is the DA14580. So I will just say the Dialog for now. So it was produced by Dialog, which has been bought by Renesas nowadays. It's a Cortex-M0, and one interesting thing is there's no flash memory in this chip. There's only a one-time programmable memory. That means that you can flash it once, and then the firmware is stayed there forever. You cannot update it, you cannot change it, nothing. But the good thing for us is that this chip has a datasheet available on the internet. So the first thing we did is to set the pinout and locate the debug interface on the various test points. We added some wires, very poorly, to be honest. But in the end, it worked, so that's perfectly fine. Now I regret registering for the soldering challenge tomorrow. So, we connected a debug probe, and unfortunately for us, the SWG interface is unresponsive. That means that there's absolutely no access to the debug interface, so we cannot extract the firmware from the device. So back to the documentation, we can see that in the red square here, it's written the debug lock JTAG. It's not JTAG, it's SWG, but whatever. So it supports this JTAG lock features. That means that apparently Chipolo did a good job and disabled the debug interface. That's pretty great for them, but not for us, because we really want that firmware. So what we did is start by the fault injection. When I say we, I want just to thank and give credits where it's due. I had a friend who worked with me on the fault injection on all the hardware side, so thanks a lot to Azox who helped me on this. So fault injection, everybody knows about fault injection? Nobody? Great. Okay. So fault injection, basically the idea of fault injection is to perturbate the CPU or the microcontroller to make it behave a bit weirdly, namely corrupting instructions or, as we say, is skipping an instruction. Basically, we make the CPU do something different than what it's supposed to do. If we do it correctly, this perturbation allows us to just modify one or a few instructions, and then the CPU continues its processing. That means that we can just change a little bit of execution, and then it resumes the execution. That will be great for us, because if we can, let's say, corrupt the set, the debug lock, then that would be great. There are a lot of different fault injection techniques that exist, namely voltage glitching, electromagnetic fault injection, and for this one, we went with electromagnetic fault injection using the chip shouter, which is showed here. So this is a tool that has been developed especially to create small electromagnetic pulses that will perturbate the CPU, hence making some instructions go weird. But now we need to know exactly where to fault. That means that we have to spot the exact instructions that will enable or disable the JTAG. And how to do this? First, with the documentation, we know exactly the boot process, how it works. So it first boots, setups the hardware. Then it will copy the OTP, so the firmware from the one-time programmable memory into RAM. And then it will remap the RAM at address 0. And then it will reset the CPU. So the CPU will start on the firmware that is in RAM. That's how this specific CPU boots. So our idea was to use power analysis. The idea is to monitor the power consumption of the microcontroller in order to see some patterns that will help us know exactly where this copy from OTP to RAM happens. So what we did was simply add some various devices to measure the power consumption and use an oscilloscope to actually see the trace and try to map the trace with what we see from the documentation. And this is how it looks like. So basically we have the boot start at the beginning here. And then from the datasheet it says that it waits for 100 milliseconds and then it will start the copy. And if you squint the eyes a bit, you will see that you have a lot of activities right there after the 100 milliseconds. So that's not that good when you are doing fault injection, because with 100 milliseconds, that means that you have a lot of jitter. So when you want to be really precise on one specific instruction, that's quite difficult to do. So there are a lot of ways to synchronize on the power consumption itself, and this will be covered later. But the thing is that using electromagnetic injection, we have to be really precise also on the parameters of the injections that we will do. Basically, if we put a fault, if we inject an EM pulse too hard, usually the target resets or crashes or burns or doesn't work anymore. That happens. Or if you do it too softly, that means that the CPU won't behave differently and you will basically have no effect at all. So what we usually do is we take the development kit for that specific microcontroller, we create a small firmware that we control so that we can actually see whether we have some instruction corruption or not. In that specific case, we didn't do it, First of all, because we didn't have any dev kits available, we didn't want to buy them, and it was pretty fun to actually test it as a black box, so using just the power analysis. So the idea is to take the trace, set some various parameters, like the width of the EM pulse, the voltage that you provide the actual coil that will generate the EM pulse, and also the physical location over the chip has some importance. So we tried to do this, but what happens is that during this small characterization phase, suddenly the SWD interface appeared. So we were really lucky, really lucky, because it worked nearly after 2 or 3 hours of testing various parameters, and we by luck, found the exact timing that allowed us to get access to the SWD. So first of all, we are quite surprised, of course, but since it was still open and the device was still working, that means it was the perfect conditions to actually dump the RAM. So we stopped the CPU, we started the dumping process from address zero, because we know that the firmware is located at address zero. And then we tried to replicate it, of course, and remember when I said that the chip can die and burn? That's exactly what happened a few attempts later. So the chip just died and it didn't work anymore. So at least we have this firmware now, so that's pretty great. And if we just have a quick look at the RAM dump, it's exactly 44 kilobytes of data, which is exactly the size of the RAM available from the datasheet. That's perfect. And if we dump the data, we show some readable strings, like the company name and other strings that, unfortunately, I cannot show you. For posterity, this is the setup that we have. So as you can see, there's no XY table. It's just a bunch of various devices connected together. In the middle there, I think the German word is Kabelsalat. That's correct. Yeah, and the chip is right here. So all the various components around is just for triggering the faults, doing the power analysis, monitoring, etc., etc. It was a nice afternoon with a lot of beers and a good friend. So now that we have this firmware, what we usually do when analyzing a firmware of an embedded device is first to load the firmware at the correct address. In that case, it's quite easy because it's from address zero, so it starts right there. We try to populate the known peripherals and registers. That's also very helpful to understand what exactly some specific functions do when they're trying to access some specific memory regions. And then we analyze the code. That's usually how it works. To do this for the peripherals and registers, usually you have, for ARM chips, you have something that is called the CMC-SVD, which is an XML file that describes all the various registers and memory regions for a specific chip. It's usually published by the manufacturers, so that's great, and there's a nice plugin which is called SVD Loader for Ghidra, IDA, and others, that allows you to basically take this XML file and populate all the memory regions within your favorite disassembler. That's pretty great. Unfortunately, of course, there's no SVD for this specific chip. So what I did is get a simple idea. Is if we have the datasheet with all the information there, we just need to parse the PDF, generate a Ghidra script that will just take those values and generate a Python script that can just copy and paste into the Python console of Ghidra, and that will be fine. Except it just doesn't work, because if you look at those, you can already see that I have 2 table number 1s. That means that the PDF is absolutely awful. There's a lot of messed tables. Some cells are merged together. Sometimes there are ghost cells with no values inside of it. So in the end, after the extractions, I had to basically rewrite everything by hand just to make sure that it works correctly. But after a lot of time, I was able to get something that looks quite nice. So I first already have all the registers and the memory regions. That's already a good result. But we are not there yet, because looking at the code, I saw that there are a lot of calls to a specific memory region that I haven't dumped, and I cannot either. And those hard-coded functions, looking at the datasheet again, It's in a specific region in ROM, so it's burned directly within the chip, and it has a lot of helper functions and functions that are used a lot. So these functions, I couldn't have them, so I don't know their names, I cannot reverse them, nothing. But luckily for me, I was able to find a simdev file on GitHub. A simdev file is a way for the ARM compiler to have some specific values, some specific function names that correspond to a specific address, and the linker will automatically convert those values to make sure that you are calling the right function. So I wrote a Git script, the link is there, it's on GitHub if you need it, because there was none before that. So with that specific Git script, and if we pull that all together, you start with the function on the left, and in the end you have the function of the right. You can see that they implemented memcopy and memcmp directly in ROM, so that's pretty convenient. So you don't need to implement your own memcopy, it's already written into the chip. And you have other functions and other helpers that typically tell you, okay, this is the Bluetooth address of the device. So now that we have everything, the registers, the memory regions, the function names a bit, we can start the reversing. So after fiddling around, I found the main application logic, which is this nice graph on the right here. So it's a huge state machine that basically handles all the various Bluetooth communication, and depending on the state it is, it will call various functions and other callbacks, etc., etc. So it's pretty messy to do, but at first, the first thing it does is some kind of comparison, and if the user sends a specific Bluetooth value, then the chip will enable all the other functions. It looks like an authentication. So looking at how this authentication data is sent, basically it's a comparison between 6 bytes that the user sends to the device and a value that is stored within the device. And that value that is stored is first the CRC32 of some random 16-byte buffer. So they are using CRC32. It's quite easy to find because you have those constant values. You can use Google, you can just Google for the values and it will directly tell you the kind of function it is. That's pretty great. There's also another script that is called FindCrypt that will help you understand which constants are used for specific crypto algorithm, and that helps a lot. So it does a CRC32 over a 16-byte buffer. And that specific buffer comes from another function that takes as an input the Bluetooth address, a fixed value that I cannot tell you, and some other value that I cannot tell you, but it's fixed. And that function, again, uses a specific constant. And if you Google for it, you will see that it's TEA, so it's the tiny encryption algorithm. So basically, this value, this secret that you need to discover, is only dependent on the Bluetooth address that you can know. But there's even more, because the CRC is only 4 bytes, and it compares to 6 bytes. So that CRC, the secret that I will call secret, is a 4-byte value. It is then mangled with a random value that is generated at boot. This value can be queried over Bluetooth. That's how the application knows the random seed. Let's call it that way. And how the seed is and how the password is calculated, it's based on the random and that specific CRC. You have all the token values, the token positions, and the formulas associated. And if you are quite decent at math, especially with XORs, you will see that if you can sniff one valid authentication, you can recover the CRC, hence the secret key for that authentication. That also means that with one authentication, you can recreate any new authentication. It's even easier because after a first successful authentication, the random value is incremented by one. It's not regenerated, it's just incremented by one. That means there are only 2 bytes that change within the token. So that was also very nice. What I did then is I installed the application to confirm that you can recover the secret value, and it works perfectly fine. And then I was thinking, okay, so maybe there might be some other vulnerabilities there. So I installed the app. I used the Bluetooth snoop log from Android to access all the various Bluetooth traffic. And I found out that the protocol uses some kind of TLV encoding, so tag length and value. So I looked at how the TLV encoding, the TLV decoding works within the firmware, and oh boy. The thing is, it takes the whole input, and it will split the input in three different stack-based buffers. So the tags will go in the tags buffer, the lengths will go in the lengths buffer, and the values will go into the values buffer. There's absolutely no bounds check, so that means it should be quite easy. You just send a very big packet, and you will be able to overflow any of those stack-based buffers. Except that, on that specific chip, the Bluetooth stack does not support changing the size of the payload in a Bluetooth packet. So it's stuck to the default of 23 bytes, and unfortunately, all the buffers are larger enough. They thought about it. So, unfortunately, there's no way to really control the data we can overflow. We can still overflow by setting a very large length value, but you cannot really control the exact values that you will overflow. So we have to go a bit deeper. Then, in the application, you have a way to upload a custom melody on the device. Some of you already see where I'm going there. So you have 9 different melodies there. So you can say, you can ask to upload a new melody at slot number from 0 to 8. Fun fact, those melodies are stored in an array. So there's an array of pointer to melody structures. And 2 of them are have a null pointer. It's a bug. They confirmed it's a bug. It shouldn't happen. But what's funny is that it allows you to overwrite directly the vector table from the chip. And that's a possibility to have remote code execution. But there's even a simpler way, because once you say, OK, I want to add to change the melody, what you can do is you will just send data as chunks to the device, and it will just copy it in the melody buffer. Of course, with absolutely no bounds checking, whatever. So you can just overwrite up to the end of the RAM if you want to. Fun fact, also, there's a way to, at the end in the application, it will send a checksum of all the melody data, and if it's valid, then it allows you to play that specific melody. But in reality, you don't need to send that CRC, and you can just ask to play the melody. I don't know why it's there. So once I know that I can overwrite basically everything I want, I scrolled in Kidra, because remember, since it's OTP copied to RAM, all the data that I copied is the RAM. So you have both the firmware and also all the buffers and pointers. That means that I just scrolled down in Kidra after the last melody structure, and the exact first value that is used, lucky for me, is a callback function. It's a pointer to a function that is called after every received Bluetooth packet or whenever I click on the button. That means that I have a way to trigger the code execution, and I have a pointer to rewrite to point to exactly my own shellcode. So the strategy is quite easy. You authenticate to the device using one of the authentication bypasses I explained earlier. Then you start to update the melody number 5 because it's the furthest down in memory. So you send a huge NOP sled, then the code, and then you overwrite this callback function, and then you just send some random Bluetooth packets, and it will trigger your payload every time. That's quite easy to do. So the first payload I did is simply hello world. By reversing the firmware, I also found the address of the function that will send a notification. So it takes the different parameters there. But you can just give it a specific value, then a pointer to a buffer, and then the length. And it will start, it will send you a notification directly. So now it's time to a small demo. Hope it will work. Just waiting for it to connect. Of course. Okay. Just in case, let's do this. Yeah, don't blame me. Blame that device. Okay, so this will basically wait until the connection. Even the demo doesn't work. That's even the backup doesn't work. Oh no, it works. Okay, it works. Okay, so now it's uploading the knob sled. That's pretty nice. What I did is I changed a bit the shellcode. This shellcode will complete the circle, so it will dump the firmware from the device over Bluetooth directly to the user. So if we wait a bit here after the end, once the knob sled is written, it will then add the shellcode, then overwrite the function pointer, and now you have the device spitting its firmware directly to the user. So as a conclusion, they say attackers only need to be lucky once. Fortunately for me, I was lucky more than once to get everything to be aligned and work perfectly. That's great. The not so good news is that those devices, since they are using one-time programmable memory, they cannot be updated. That means that you can still purchase them if you want to test for yourself, if you want. Thanks again to Chipolo, because they sent us several devices to play with. That's really nice to them. And that's it.
So, thank you very much for your talk, and also the demonstration. Do we have questions here? So I see someone lining up on the left.
Yeah, so I have a question. You said there's no way to update the firmware. Okay, fair. But we can upload melodies, right?
Yes.
And it will be stored, I think, with changing the battery, right?
It will be stored in RAM,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, correct. So is it possible to just insert your own code on the melody store? Like we do the remote code execution, right? And then store our own custom code and like that kind of have our custom firmware.
Mm-hmm.
Is that possible?
That's possible. The only thing is that if the device reboots, then the patch will be gone as well, because it will restart, then reload the firmware from the OTP memory to RAM, etc. So you will have to exploit your device every time it reboots.
Oh, OK, yeah. Now I understand. OK, yeah. Thank you.
That was also quite helpful, because whenever the shellcode crashed, and it crashed a lot at the beginning, every time the device crashes, it automatically reboots and does this smaller. There's no melody now because it's exploited. But it does this small melody every time it reboots. So I knew exactly when the exploit failed and I had to rewrite it, etc.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we also have a question from the internet.
I think the question was already covered. It was if the melody feature is only working until the device is rebooted, so it's only stored in RAM and lost after reboot.
Yes.
Okay, thanks. Then we have a question in the middle on the right.
I have a question.
One question, can you enable JTAG or SWD debugging once you have your own firmware loaded?
Thank you. Yes, you can. Basically, I did, after I had this way of dumping every memory region, I dumped the ROM code. So I looked at the part of the code that is responsible for locking or unlocking the chip. And it does exactly that. So it just sets a specific bit in that specific register, and you can do it by using remote code execution as well. Yes. So you can create a shellcode that will just update one specific value at a specific memory location, and you have JTAG again, SWD, to be correct.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Microphone two.
Hi, thank you for this great talk. And I have one question just for the record. So do you think they use the same keys in every device? So
no idea.
They don't.
No, I have
no idea. Did you exploit more than one?
On this device, it's the same key. Yes. But on every device, but on the other models, I honestly didn't have time to try them already, so I don't know.
All right, thank you.
So, I guess since no one is rushing to the microphones again, and we don't have any questions left from the internet, I want to thank you again for the wonderful talk.
Thank you.
And a warm applause, please.
Thanks.